Well, hello. Welcome to Prosecco Queens podcast. Pop that bottle and settle in, because today we're kicking off a powerful new series, one that's all about parenting, our relationships with our kids, and the unexpected ways that learning to parent differently actually helps heal us too. Parenting isn't just about raising kids. It's about breaking cycles, rewriting old narratives, and growing alongside them. And let's be real, it's not always fun and games. Raising young women and young men is tough stuff, but together we can empower the next generation to navigate friendships, technology, and all the challenges life throws their way. To start this journey, I've got the perfect guest, award-winning author Jessica Speer. Jessica has a way of making the tricky social stuff, friendships, screen time, and middle school drama actually make sense. She blends social science, real stories, and interactive activities to give kids, teens, and parents the tools they need to handle relationships and the digital world with confidence. She is the brilliant mind behind books like The Phone Book, Stay Safe, Be Smart, and Make the World Better with the Powerful Device in Your Hand, BFF or NRF. Not Really Friends, A Girl's Guide to Happy Friendships, and Middle School Safety Goggles Advised. If you've ever struggled with friendships, screen time battles, or just surviving middle school drama, Jessica's got you covered. Her work isn't just about helping kids. It's about strengthening social awareness, fostering resilience, and giving families the tools to thrive. And as we explore parenting in this series, we're diving deep into the why behind it all. How we can show up differently, heal ourselves in the process, and raise strong, self-aware kids who are ready to take on the world. So, whether you're a parent trying to decode your child's world, like me, a teacher looking for insights, or just someone who loves a fresh take on relationships and technology, this episode and this entire series is for you. Jessica, welcome to Prosecco Queens podcast. I'm so thrilled that you're here with me today.
Thank you for having me, Teresa. And thanks for that very kind, generous introduction. I'm so excited to talk to you about some of these hard stuff like parenting, social struggles and screens, you know, right there in a nutshell. That's hard stuff to deal with.
It's hard stuff for adults. So I know I gave the audience kind of a little background, but I would like you, if you don't mind, to give us some really good meat about you.
Sure. Well, my name is Jessica Speer, and I've got a background in social sciences and a degree, a master's degree in that. And I've always just been fascinated with human relationships. And then I became a parent, and that became even more so, especially when I've got two daughters, especially when they hit elementary school and things started to get tricky. You know, social stuff was no longer so simple. That got me curious as a social scientist, and I started a friendship program that actually ran in schools. And that friendship program grew into my first book that has that funky title, BFF or NRF, which is Not Really Friends. So that got me started. And then they hit middle school, and talk about interesting.
Yeah.
That, you know, then I spent a year kind of studying what was happening in middle school, talking to middle schoolers. That grew into my second book, Middle School Safety Goggles Advised. And then the pandemic hit and we all got sucked into our screens. And then the phone book was born. You know, so I've just kind of been following this trajectory of seeing what's happening in my family and what's happening, you know, in the families that are in our world. So lots of stuff to explore and talk about tonight.
I love that, because you're following the trends, right? You know, things like, for example, TikTok that really started to hype up in the pandemic when everybody was looking for a way to connect where we couldn't do it physically. I just got on TikTok probably about 9 months ago because of the podcast. I can see how some people can really get sucked in, and especially kids. And that's just one of them. There's Snapchat. You know, we're all on Instagram and Facebook and those things. So I have a daughter who is going to be 19 this year. And so during the pandemic, she was in middle school and then starting high school. And I remember that shift. Right. She was always just one that was very free spirited. She was like, just had whatever friends she had. She wasn't popular. She wasn't not popular. She did sports. She just had a good time. Right. In life. And then the pandemic hit and a lot of things changed for all of them. If you were bullied, you know, you were bullied in person. If you were exiled by your friend group, well, guess what? You sat by yourself. Right. It was really survival of the fittest. Now it's like, well, you don't want to talk to me. I can talk to somebody else, the 6 billion other people. Right. So in these early teen years, we know that it feels like a social minefield. So why do friendship struggles and social challenges seem to peak during this time?
That's such a great question. And I think once parents know this, it's a little bit of a relief, because sometimes we as parents get really nervous when we see our kids and teens start to struggle. Like, wait, what is happening? And there's a lot happening. Okay, so a couple of things that are going on that starts Starting around age 10, but not for everybody, you know, because they all kids are growing and developing at a different pace. I find that girls tend to start a little bit earlier because they tend to start adolescence a couple years earlier than boys. So what's happening is this process that kids have over the course of their childhood of individuation, that starts to really kick into gear. So they're, you know, as from the moment they're you know, toddlers are starting to exert their independence. That really kicks in the preteen years. And they're starting to figure out, well, hey, who am I? And what do I like? And who are my friends? And so what that does is it puts a lot more weight in their friendships. So all of a sudden, these friendships are really important. However, everyone's friendship skills are still pretty rough. No, right. They're kids, they're preteens, they're teens. There's a lot of skills that go into friendship and a lot of roughness there. So there ensues some conflict. When the preteen years hit, especially for girls, confidence dips. For girls, confidence can dip up to 30% between age 8 and 12. And when That's we're terrible. Not feeling confident in ourselves, that gets reflected in our relationships too. And then again, as they're hitting puberty, they're starting to, in addition to hormones going on and changes in their brain, they're starting to, you know, just be interested in different things. And I see in middle school, all of a sudden, this really close friendship might break apart because one might all of a sudden be so into crushes and the other one's not. And there's no longer a fit there. All these things, you know, throw it all together and it makes sense that there's a lot of change and a lot of strife going on because they're just trying to figure it out during a very phase of life which is filled with huge change.
It's true. I think back to, you know, my daughter was in Girl Scouts. And it's kind of funny how as parents, we don't forget what we went through as kids, right? As teenagers, because we all went through these things, the same things. I remember there are very significant moments for me as a preteen and teen that I don't forget in relationships with my friends, right? And those feelings of, oh my gosh, I'm going to lose my friends forever. It's, you know, you don't realize like that's not as important as we think, for, you know, when you're that age, right? But I remember my daughter was in Girl Scouts. And she was with the same group of girls, 5 years, maybe 6 years. They were all their moms. All of us were friends. We watched these girls grow from kindergarten. Then they got to middle school. And all of a sudden, I would say to my daughter, I'd be like, oh, have you spoken to so-and-so? And she's like, no. And I'm like, why not? She's like, and these girls were in my house, birthday parties and everything else. And she was like, no. And I was like, why? And she's like, because I don't like her. And I was like, why? She was like, because she's not nice and she hangs out with this group and so on. And, you know, when this one hangs out with this group and she's like, I have my group. And it's really funny because you do forget that happens. I grew up very close knit with my friends because we were in a Catholic school. We grew up, there was one class of each grade. So you literally grew up with the same people, right? Only if someone came in. Did they kind of get added in there? It was a very small group of girls that we were all very tight that to this day, we still talk every once in a while, all of us, right? There was like 13 of us, if that much. So for me, I was always like, that seems a little odd. You know what I'm saying? That it was such a big divide. But I guess it does make sense, you know, because obviously if someone is not interested in something versus something else, you're going to have a different friend group and you're going to develop different interests, I guess. And some people just don't follow suit. And we know that hormones also is a huge thing. Girls, again, I speak girls at this point because like you, I have the older girl. My son is still pre-tween, so he hasn't hit that really hormonal stage yet. So I don't know what to expect for a boy. Hindsight, obviously, because she's older now. I wonder, does brain development and social pressures impact the way preteens and teens navigate friendships? And what are some common mistakes that we make trying to help them through these social struggles, trying to almost fit them into a mold that we all kind of somehow end up doing or realize it, fitting them into a mold that we think they should be? We all make that mistake.
Yes, yes. And, you know, as far as the brain development question. So the changes that are going along with puberty have chemical changes in the body and the brain that make adolescents feel their emotions more deeply. So when something happens, that's why it appears that it's, you know, you see this huge mood swing or just
like the world is ending all the time.
Yes. And so, yeah. So there's a reason for that. You know, I know we might roll our eyes as adults, but there's a reason for that. They're actually feeling that intensity in their body. So one thing that we can do as adults, what is so helpful to them is if we don't get caught up in that emotion and we are really grounded, we stay grounded. We don't go off on our own emotional roller coaster. We stay grounded because then we're modeling regulation. So a dysregulated adult can never help a kid or teen regulate. You know, we have to be regulated ourselves before we can help them. So just a side tip, and I've done it too.
Yes.
Because sometimes when we see our kids really emotional, it stirs something in us. So,
yes.
So that's like my personal practice is when my girls come home and they're really amped up, I take a deep breath and feel my feet on the floor. Let me be present with them and let me be regulated to help them regulate their or learn how to regulate their emotions. Because that's a skill. You know, as kids, we learn how to regulate our emotions in healthy ways, hopefully. You know, if not, then in later in life, we're learning how to try to regulate our emotions.
And sometimes it's so much later in life, right?
Yes,
like
exactly.
It took me over 40 years to even realize I had to do that.
And so the second part of your question, which is on social pressure. Okay, so we talked earlier about this phase of life, fitting in becomes so important because they're individuating. So all of a sudden, their peers matter so, so much. And so that sense of belonging and acceptance is huge. So that's why we also see some kids and teens really conforming and doing things we wouldn't expect them to be doing. You know, all of a sudden, they're just really concerned about fitting in and having this latest pair of shoes. And so that becomes really important too. So just knowing that, that's all real. That's all developmentally appropriate and it really matters to them. You know, it's just really important. So try not to belittle that. You know, that's just kind of where they are, but we can remind them. You know, it never hurts to remind them that, you know, we believe in them. Awesome, just the way they are. You know, even though they might roll their eyes. Yeah, we can just, you know, just keep believing in them and show them, you know, that we love them as they are and they're okay as they are, but They're going to try to fit in with their peers no matter what. That's kind of where they are in life.
That's very true. And I remember that with myself. You know, I had friends that grew up with more money. You know what I mean? We went to the same Catholic school, but I was the one, you know, in the little one bedroom apartment with my family. And I had friends a lot of them with houses and, you know, the latest shoes. And, you know, and I used to get so, I remember used to being embarrassed because I used to wear sneakers that were like from Payless. Remember Payless shoe stores?
Yes.
And to this day, I still wish they were around because they were great shoes. But at the time, 13 and 14 years old, I was determined to have my first pair of Jordans, determined to have my first pair of Nikes because, you know, looking back in hindsight, I was like, I didn't go without. I had everything I needed. We just didn't have all this excess, right, to give certain things. It was a very different lifestyle. And I think what you're saying is obviously spot on is that some kids, I was lucky. My daughter never felt like she had to fit into any mold. She was always just who she was. She didn't really care for all those kinds of things. But maybe that's also because when I look back too, I gave her those things without even realizing it. It could have been because I didn't have it in my own childhood. I think part of my healing journey is me saying, you know what? I think I gave my kids, like, I like them to have the Jordans if I can, or to have certain things if I can, because if I'm able to give it to them, it's almost like healing me in a way and that I didn't have them when I was younger. And I had mentioned and asked you before, maybe this kind of ties into that as well, because us as parents, obviously we make mistakes and I think parenting sometimes helps us heal our childhood patterns. Some people that just exacerbates old childhood patterns and some never learn it. It's just parenting another generation of unhealed people, unfortunately. So what are some mistakes that parents make in dealing with these social struggles with our children?
Well, one I touched on earlier is getting a little too emotionally involved.
Yes.
You know, so try to stay really grounded and avoid reacting. You know, just stay settled, but take what they're saying seriously. Know that these emotions are real. These situations, they're feeling very real to them. So validation is one of the key things we can do, is this validating. And for me, some of the phrases I say the most are, oh my gosh, that sounds really hard. Or I'm so sorry that happened. Like, just validating that what they experienced was really hard instead of, you know, discounting that. You know, so keep those in your back pocket. Like, I'm so sorry that happened, or that sounds really hard. So validating one, another, getting involved. And so I've seen this backfire so horribly, and I've even gotten overstepped things and gotten too involved in, and it often doesn't work out well. One, we don't know the whole story, and often what happened is triggered by something that happened 10 weeks ago or, you know, or 10 months
yes.
ago. Like, so we're hearing one side of one piece of a story, and yes. it's usually much deeper than so it's, and we're hearing one perspective. So, you know, by us getting involved, it often doesn't help. And then it shows our kids that we don't have the confidence that they can handle it. So what I try to do is, you know, once I've validated the experience, you know, say, what do you think your options are here? You know, so by doing that, I'm showing them I have confidence in them, that they can come up with some ideas and helping them formulate some of those. And I'm not, you know, stepping in, because sometimes when I step in right away with my ideas, they're so bad. Like, you know, we often have just horrible advice. We think our advice is awesome. It yes. might be awesome in some circumstances, but every social dynamic is so complex that what we say might mean so little that it might shut off the conversation. So we start with like, what do you think your options are? And often there's nothing that needs to be done. They just need to vent. They just need to share this yeah. experience, get it off their chest. Just giving somebody the chance to share yeah. is healing. Yeah. It's so healing. So don't feel like we need to fix or solve. If we can just try to keep our mouth shut, just listen and validate. Often that's all that needs to happen. But if not, if maybe more, you know, then we can say, hey, would you like some ideas on that? So see right. if they want some input, because I have made the mistake so many times of just jumping in with some sort of idea, and it just shuts the conversation down, and it shows that I don't believe that they can handle this. It shows that I might be clueless because what I shared is totally unrealistic for their lives. Right. But yeah, so those would be the ways I'd handle that, which is hard. You know, we want to get in there and fix. We want to make them feel better as quickly yes. as possible. You know, the best way to do that is to validate and listen and stay grounded ourselves. That is the key to helping them.
I would say it's so hard because it's true. You want to get in there and kiss their boo-boos, mm-hmm. right? It doesn't matter how big they are. You want to go in there because you still look at them as this. It's hard because sometimes I look at my daughter and I go, where did you come from? Because like she's grown, right? Like she's still my baby, but she's grown and she's a young grown woman. But I still look at her and I look at like the pictures of this little baby. I'm like, when did this happen? And it's like, I still sometimes when I see her hurt, want to just kiss it away. I want to be like, mm-hmm. just dissolve it away and say, you know, no, I got this. I'll take care of it. But, you know, I think we all, and I say mistake loosely only because I think as parents, we may not see it as a mistake. Because we're just trying to protect our kids, but we have to be as judgmentless as that's not a good word, but as possible. And that's hard too, because there are times you want to jump in and go, wait a second, that's wrong. You don't do that. It's dangerous, whatever the case may be. And I sometimes have to sit back and say, hold on. She was careful enough and she wants to come talk to me about this.
Mm-hmm.
If you're judging the situation, then you're going to jeopardize her coming to you again when she whether wants to vent or actually get some kind of direction or instruction or advice.
Yes. So, so true. You know, it just breaks down any long-term sustainable connection with you.
Yeah.
So yeah, the best way to like try to maintain a sustainable connection with our kids is to try to be that grounded sounding board. You know, that they know that they come to us, we're not going to freak out. So
right.
they know that they can come to us and we're just not going to get overly involved. We're not going to freak out. We're going to listen. We're going to listen to them. And if they ask for help, we're going to help them.
I have a bad habit. There are times that I've had to be the snap out of it parent. You know, I am also a single mom. So I really am mom and dad 99.99% of the time. And I'm always like, listen, I'm going to coddle you for a bit. But I also got to tell you, I'm not going to do it the whole time, right? Now you got to do it with the tough love. And I think that's really hard too for some parents, because I feel guilty sometimes after the tough love, but I have to sit down and talk to her afterwards. Like, listen, I'm not trying to be hard on you. You are going to heal. You are going to struggle. You're going to do things on your time. But the idea is I need you to understand that wallowing for so long is not going to do anything either. Nobody can change you. Nobody can heal you. We can just support you, right? Back in the day, there wasn't really communication like that with your parents. It was basically you were living two separate lives in the same house and that was it. And their job was to raise you and you're on your own. And that was really it. So what is it about us and this generation or Gen Xers, millennials that we're raising these Gen Zs and Gen Alpha, because that's my son who's a Gen Alpha, and we're raising them very differently. I think personally, and what I've seen on my journey, is a lot of it is because of the way I was raised. I always said I wasn't going to do the same to my kids. I want a relationship with my kids. I want to love my kids and hug on them as much as possible. And I want them to know that and to be able to come to me. But people say that we might be too soft on our kids. So what is the reason that we're just, there's just such a hard divide as to what we're doing wrong, I guess, or what we're told we're doing wrong?
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, I remember growing up and wishing I could talk to my mom about things.
Me too.
But I didn't, because I knew she'd jump in with advice that really made me feel unheard.
Yes.
I stopped. I went into parenting knowing I wanted to change that. So I think what you said is absolutely true. What we try to do with our kids is maybe not replicate the things that we didn't appreciate growing up with. And sometimes we can overdo that. But I do have to say, what I do love about Parents Today and podcasts like yours, Teresa, is parents are really trying,
really trying
their best to raise healthy kids, you know, and to stay connected to them. So I love that parents are trying. I love that you're doing this podcast and we're learning. So I think hats off to us. So yes, yeah, we're going to overstep, you know, but I would say I feel so connected. I've got two daughters and I feel so connected to them. Not overly so. Like, I know when I need to pull back, I need to let them struggle, because struggle is important. So I know that because I've listened to lots of podcasts and read books. Yeah. You know, I've learned that. But I think parents today are actually doing an amazing job. So all the parents out there listening, go easy on yourself. And kudos to you for tuning in and listening. You know, we're doing this because we want to raise a really loved, supported generation of kids. Right. And I think that's happening.
I do agree. I think, you know, there's a weird dichotomy going on, because, and I mentioned this actually in other episodes, which is so funny, is that we have more empathetic children. We have more because of the social emotional learning in schools, right? Mm-hmm. They really know how to make their voices heard in a proper way, right? They know how to speak their voices and actually be heard in ways that we were told to not do. Right? To just be seen and not heard. They're very, and I say social loosely as well, because this is kind of where the whole, like, your book, The Phone Book, comes into play, right? Because our kids have so much empathy, right? They can see now, they have access to all the different types of lifestyles. And the dichotomy stands in where we laugh because they might be the most emotionally connected. However, they're not always the brightest when it comes to certain things. Maybe book smart, but when it comes to things like common sense, there seems to be somewhere like a weird disconnect where we had to raise ourselves and had no choice but to gain that common sense out of experience. And I think somewhere with the phones and having access to everything at their fingertips, I feel like they still, that's almost like a catch-22 in itself. It's like the kind of the more you have in front of you, the less you know, mm-hmm. and the less you know how to be in person. Because technology is so woven into our kids' lives now more than ever, when we didn't have any of that. But what are some surprising statistics, if you have any, about kids and screens that parents should be aware of?
You know, I one thing that I think is really important to know is, you know, a lot of young kids are on social media before the age of 13. So you know, there's this number 13, which is such an arbitrary age that was drawn up way back, even before social media came to play.
Oh, it did.
Yeah. So it's just this arbitrary number, which some people think that is actually still too early, because kids are still in that identity forming stage of adolescence. And then once you add social media, that's a lot to deal with when you're actually trying to figure out your own identity. But beside the point, so a lot of younger than 13-year-olds are on social media and getting a lot of content that is really not intended for 10, 9,
Agreed.
11-year-olds. The average age, let's just dive right in. The average age that, you know, kids come across porn is 11.
I was going to ask you.
I think it's important. That's the average. That means half of those are earlier and often. So I visit a lot of schools and I talk to schools, and what parents are telling me, because my girls are teens now, what parents are telling me is often it's innocent. Like, they might just be doing a Google search because they're curious about puberty, and then boom, something, you know, or they're shared, because their age isn't correct in social media, they're shared some stuff that way, you know, so it's accidental, or, you know, somebody, friends, like, hey, look at this. You know, so I think it's really important, as soon as our kids have a fully connected device, especially one they're using outside of the home, we have to have those conversations. We have to explain what this is, you know, and what to do when they see it. And so That's a big one. I think parents don't realize how early kids are seeing really inappropriate stuff. That's a tricky one. I'm trying to think, what's another? Oh, the hour. Another statistic is just hours. So preteens, it used to be about 7. It's now about 9 hours a day on devices outside of schools. So there's their schoolwork, and then there's, 7 to 9 hours on devices, which I think we have to think about is, what is that displacing? Some of that is perfectly awesome, healthy stuff. They're playing games, they're listening to music, stuff that we did just on a device. But some of it is displacing things that's really healthy, like sleep and,
playing outside.
Yeah, exercise, moving their bodies, learning how to communicate face-to-face. So that number is so huge. It's almost every waking hour now is on a device that we just have to realize as a society that's displacing some really important things for their health. And so it's not surprising to me that we have, anxiety and depression, issue in the world with preteens and teens. I think it's that displacement of other really important functions that are now just happening on screens.
And I agree with that completely. My son, like I said, he'll be 9 this year. And there are some days, like I work from home some days. So if he's home, for example, day off from school or something, I'm working. This kid could be on this 9, 10, 11, 12 hours from the second he wakes up in the morning. And he's got friends, little friends that are around the country. Right. He's got a little friend in Puerto Rico. He's got one in Kentucky, and they all look for each other. They call. But I hear that phone ring at the tablet all the time, and they're playing. They have a little friend group and they're playing together. But there are times I have to say to him, look, your friends just came to the door. Go play outside for a little bit. You can't just sit here. You're going to end up hunched back. You're going to end up, you're not getting this exercise that you need. Too much screen time. You're not going to sleep well, right? That's the other thing, because we all have that. We all have that affliction as well, is we're just right up until the second we fall asleep and the phone hits us in the face. We're sitting there with the phone in our face. I did it the other night, unfortunately, it smacked me right in the face. And I was like, I should be asleep right now instead of the phone in my hand. So how can parents model these healthy tech habits themselves while we stay connected? Because, I like to be on my phone too. I like to play my game more than anything else. But how can I get mad when my son is in the room doing the same thing? Right. You see what I'm saying?
Right. Yes. Okay. And this is such an important topic. And before I dive into how to build those healthy habits, in the conversation, I really encourage families to have on an ongoing basis is really helping young people understand the tech business model. So technology is designed to keep us on it.
It's addicted.
So there's persuasive design, which is, tagging and endless scrolls and notifications. So all these beautifully designed devices that keep us checking, so
agreed.
It's dopamine hits. So I think kids have to understand that, tech companies make money the more time we stare at screens, through advertising. So I think the more informed they are, the better. Let's make them informed consumers. So help them, have that conversation just to know that that's how it works at this point in time.
Algorithm.
Yeah, exactly.
It will suck you in.
Knowing that, so that then can open the conversation. How do we as a family want to make sure we are having a healthy balance? Because our job as parents is to make sure you grow up healthy and safe. And so how can we do that? So talking about the importance of sleep, talking about the importance of moving your body, talking the importance about doing things like chores and homework before we relax in front of our screen. So just talking that through as a family. And then what I always suggest is if families put together some sort of, you can call it a media agreement. Some people call it a family tech agreement, and do it as a family. Like, this is a great family sit down dinner conversation, and don't feel like it's daunting. You could just Google, family tech agreement, and you'll see all these options. And then you as a family can sit down and work on it together. So for instance, when we first gave our kids devices, our family tech agreement had a few rules that we came together as a family. One of the rules was, we don't do screens at meals, so that's just all. And we've done it for so long since they were so little. That's,
second nature
now. Yeah. That's, they wouldn't even consider bringing their phone to
Love
the dinner
that.
Table. Yeah. And then two, again, to protect sleep, maybe there's no phones or screens in bed at night, so you can decide that what works for your family, and can you as the adult comply? There's no texting while driving. So this one's really important. Like when I was teaching my girls to drive.
Yes.
Absolutely. If I started to pick up my phone and look at it while I'm driving, what am I modeling to my teenagers?
Right.
That's okay. Yeah.
Right.
So you pick the things that are just really important for you as a family. Again, coming from, let's figure out as a family how to create some healthy balance in our lives with screens. Screens are amazing. I don't know what we did without them.
Right.
But what can we do to keep this really healthy so we as a family can stay connected and we can take care of our bodies?
So what could a parent do then if they feel they've already lost control? Quote unquote, lost control over their kids' screen habits, where they can start to regain balance. Because I love the idea of your, you just said it was called a family tech agreement. Thank you. Family tech agreement. I love that. I wouldn't even have really thought about that, to be honest myself, but I'm going to look into that now, actually. But say at this point, I don't think I've lost control, but there are people to the extreme. How do you think would be the best way to kind of rein it in and regain some balance? Like, you know, because sometimes at this point, for some parents, are like, I don't know what to do. He's already too deep, or she's already too deep in. And no matter what I say, the kids are going to have withdrawal. They're going to resent me. And all these things we worry about as parents. Now, I was also raised a little differently. If I take it away from you, you just know I'm going to take it away and I'm not going to feel bad about it. But I'm also the kind of mom that then feels bad about it and says, well, maybe, you know, maybe just a little bit. So where can we kind of balance that power out and try to regain some balance in your child's life and also in your household?
Yeah, and it's never too late, because this happens a lot to a lot of families. They give the device, and then because the device is designed to addict us, it does. You know,
so
don't feel bad if this has happened and you're feeling like, oh, this is too late and out of control. It's not. But start small and start intentionally. So in a calm moment, not when you're having a conflict over screens, in another calm moment, bring up and make it about you. Bring up that, you know, I realize I goofed. You know, when I gave you this phone, you know, I didn't think through, you know, some ways to make sure that you're creating some healthy balance in your life. And that's on me. You know, I goofed there. But what I'd like to do as a family, because I do think it's really important to learn how to balance screens and to exercise and sleep enough, I'd like to think of ways that we can bring that balance into our family. You know, what ideas do you have? You know, and so start with that. Your first thing might be really small. It might be just no screens at the table. Okay. And let that go for a while, weeks, months, and then maybe try it again, you know, and then maybe we're adding, you know, I've noticed, you know, that you are so sleepy during the day. And my job as a mom is to make sure you get enough sleep, because sleep is the basis of well-being and learning. So I'd like to talk to you about maybe not sleeping with your phone. You know, can we talk about that? So I'm, yes, I'm doing this really calmly, step by step, you're not right, in a threatening way, trying to engage them. But, you know, when I need to have these conversations with my kids, I always come from, you know, my goal as a parent is to keep you healthy. And, yeah. And so, so a lot of this is coming from health and safety for them. Yes.
It's funny that you talk about that, because since my son's little, obviously, and he's a COVID toddler, right? So he started out preschool, and then he was home right after that for, like, you know, years, obviously, at this point, up until kindergarten. And so they're used to having, you know, the screens in their face. And there'll be moments that I will see this kid from morning until night with the tablet in his hand, like a suitcase. Like, he's holding it, walking around the house. It doesn't matter where he's going. If he's in the shower, it's sitting on the thing outside so he can listen to it. If he's talking to his friends, from the moment he wakes up in the morning to the moment, you know, when he's on school or playing or going to sports, he goes to bed. And so it got to a point that I was like, listen, when you're eating with us, like you were saying, no tablets, no phones, no tablets. He doesn't have a phone anyway, but no tablets. He's already asked me for a phone. I'm like, are you crazy? Who are you going to call? Me. I was like, that's no, absolutely not. You don't need a phone. You're 8 years old. That's crazy, you know? And, you know, he would say, want to go, if we would go for a long car ride, I'd say, yeah, take your tablet, fine. So you don't have to listen to what we're listening to, whatever you want. But it got to the point that we'd be going from my house to the store, and he'd be like, can I bring my tablet? Absolutely, you cannot. Like, there's no reason for that ride. And he's gotten used to those things, right? Where it's like, I told you no tablet right now. Okay, fine. And he'll put it aside, you know? And I think sometimes you have to be a little hard on them too, in the sense that sometimes you have to not only model it, but also say to them, listen, this is the rule.
Yeah.
Right. Cause sometimes they're just like so used to it, so addictive. It's just like attached. It's like a burning, you know, in your hand. And it's really wild to me that, cause as adults, it's happened to us as well. If we leave the house and don't have the phone, I can't speak for anybody else but myself, but I damn near freak out.
Yeah, there's a name for that. It's called nomophobia. It's the, you know, the,
wow,
the yeah, it's the reaction we have when we feel like we've lost our phone or forgot our phone. And so just to, you know, the first chapter in the phone book, which I wrote for kids about to get a phone, is why tech companies want you staring at your screen. So, you know, just if parents are like on the verge of they're about to give their kid a phone or they recently did, that book has all the conversations you want to have. It's written for kids, but I encourage their adults to read it too, because it starts all those conversations. Yeah. So chapter one, why do tech companies want you staring at your screen? There's also a chapter on social media. There's a chapter on stranger danger. There's a chapter on cyberbullying and digital drama.
Love
and there's
it.
A chapter on disinformation. So I wrote it because when I was about to hand over the phone, I'm like, oh my gosh, there's so many conversations I need to have with my kid. You know, so I put it in a book for kids, but there's, you know, positives too, because, you know, there's amazing things about technology and kids tune us out. If we're just harping the negative,
Agreed.
They just tune us out. So we have to balance those conversations with the really cool things, but arm them with the information so they are informed consumers and they know how to keep themselves safe. But back to your original point, kids do better with boundaries. So if parents are concerned, you know, rules are bad, rules actually show our kids that we care about them, you know,
so
it helps them to feel safe, that somebody's looking out for them. So don't be afraid of rules and boundaries. You know, that actually has been proven in research to show that it helps kids be more successful.
I agree. It gives them that basis, like this, that grounding that they need as well. You know, sometimes when kids go kind of like off the rocker, it's a lot of times because they don't have enough grounding in their lives to bring them back. You know, they're just like all over the place because they don't know how to regulate themselves. I mean, we obviously know there's millions probably of unregulated adults walking out there, that if they had a little more regulation in their lives and teaching how to regulate themselves, they'd have very different outcomes in so much of their lives. And that actually makes me want to go to your next book, or maybe not your next book. I remember the order that you had said you had put them out, but from BFF or NRF, A Friendship Truths and Friendship Pyramid, you talk about 9 friendship truths. So would you mind sharing a few that really resonate with both adults and kids?
Yes, and all of them do. So I think, you know, that book is written for, you know, again, 7 to 13-year-olds. However, everything in that is, you know, replies to all of life.
We can all learn how to talk to our kids better and learn ourselves, right?
Yes. And where these friendship truths came from is when I was working with kids and working with them in friendship groups, I found that sometimes if I was front-loading some knowledge that we learn later in life, it was a huge relief to them. So one of the friendship truths is friendships have different phases and change over time. And, you know, and we learn that as adults, but when that starts to happening to kids in elementary and middle, they're wondering like, what is going on? You know, or something wrong with me. So it's a huge relief for them to know that friendships do have different phases.
And that's really scary too, when you're that age, right?
Like,
who am I going to have lunch with? Who am I going to sit with? Oh my God, my best friend's not calling me. Are they doing stuff that I'm not doing? Why am I not included? Exactly.
Yeah. It feels horrible, but it's super common. So that's one of the friendship truths and a relief to kids. Another one is close friends can be hard to find. And so there comes again, when kids are individuating, they're looking for this closeness with peers, but it is hard to find that. And so they can feel very alone. They can feel that, like, it looks like everybody has a BFF except them. But the truth is, it's hard to find close friends. And most of us have less than 5. And some of those are family members, you know, over the course of our lives. So just let them know that too. That's another relief for them.
Can I caveat there real quick? Because you just hit the nail on the head with something me and my daughter went through. Exactly that. In high school, middle school to high school, it was always like, how come I don't have a best friend? How come I have friendships with people? And I kept saying, you know, listen, I had a lot of friends too. Her godmother I've known since she's 9, but we were always good friends. It wasn't until we became adults. We were always good friends, but you know, we had our times where we broke up and we didn't speak for like 6 years. And then it was time that we came back as adults and it was like, she's one of my soulmates. She's just one of the loves of my life, right? And she's my daughter's godmother. And my daughter doesn't know what time that we weren't friends or we weren't together. And I said, I have maybe 2 friends, not including my wonderful sister and my cousins that are my sisters. But when it comes to friends from other mothers, I have 2.
Yeah.
Like 2 real ones. I said, some people don't find their best friends until they're in college, and that's their roommate sometimes. Some is a coworker when you're an adult, if you're lucky. Some people just have acquaintances. Not everybody's going to find the person that they're going to take vacations with when they're older. So thank you for that, because I had that conversation so much and I thought it was just me trying to rationalize it. And I'm sure other parents feel that way as well, just trying to comfort their kid.
Yeah, and it's so true. You know, we forget that kids might not know this yet. In fact, I was doing a school visit and I was doing a big assembly. After I finished, I'd share these truths with kids with stories. And this little boy from the front row comes up afterward and he just hugs me and he says, "Thank you." And all I did was share some of these friendship truths. But for him, it was so powerful to know that close friends can be hard to find. You know, there's nothing wrong with him. He's okay. It's totally normal for his friendships to change. So yeah, it's funny how these little things, you know, we think everybody knows, but kids don't know these things. And we always need reminders, especially when we're in the middle of a big change. It's good to be reminded of these things.
It's kind of like when they say to the kids in class, ask the question, because you think you're the only person that has the question, but you're not. You're going to help 10 other kids in the class. Don't be shy. We all sit there like, when we were kids, like, I'm not going to ask the question. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to be the one to ask. I'm not going to embarrass myself. And 10 other kids are thinking, I'm not going to answer that. I'm not going to ask that question. All the same thing, right? If someone doesn't speak it, someone doesn't hear it, people feel so alone.
Mm-hmm. So true. So true.
That feeling of being the only one that feels this. Mm-hmm. Why is it only me? When reality, it's the majority.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So true.
So can you explain the friendship pyramid and how can we understand it as parents and how does it relate to our kids and building healthier friendships?
Our relationships.
And this is also out of that first book, BFF or NRF, Not Really Friends. And anybody can find this. It's free. It's all over the internet. If you just search friendship pyramid, Jessica Spear, you'll come up with a PDF. And it's something that parents often just put on the fridge because it helps. Really? It shares a lot of these friendship truths in one simple graphic. And it helps when things get tough. And so we'll picture this pyramid in our head. So picture a pyramid, the very tippy top, very small. Like this pyramid is not in three even parts. It's got a very small shaded top that is our close friends. And then I have the qualities of our close friends there. But under that, it says hard to find. Just so there's that reminder of that truth, hard to find. And these friendships are, you know, very trusting and they take a while to develop. And so what are those qualities? Underneath that, a huge swath of the pyramid, I label as friends. And I am very liberal with this. Those could be neighbors. Those could be teammates. Those are classmates. So because kids and teens are still learning friendship skills, these friendships are far from perfect. So that's why it's wide. There's a lot of people in there that they're just people that you enjoy being around, you know, that know you. You know, you hang out sometimes, some more than others. Some you feel comfortable with. Some you might not even yet feel comfortable with because they're kind of a new friend. And then at the base of that is acquaintances. So people that we keep our minds open, that there's a lot of people out there that are possible friends. So sometimes, especially in middle school, kids start to shut down, maybe not open to new friendships, closing off their groups. But if we can stay open to meeting new people and meeting new friends, you know, that's just going to help us in the long run. So staying open to that. But then separate to the pyramid, I've got what I call NRFs, which is the not really friends.
The not really friends.
Yes. And so this, I think, is maybe what helps parents so much is if your child or teen finds themselves in a relationship that doesn't feel at all like friendship. And I put the qualities of that. So maybe there's been some big breaches of trust. Maybe they're nice to you some days, but they're really mean to you other days. Maybe you feel really uncomfortable being yourself. So I'd state those things under not really friends. And I can't tell you, I labored over, like, I don't want to create another label in the world. I don't want to call this mean girls. I don't want to call this bullying. I don't want to call this anything that's going to then turn into a label. I just wanted to say something that describes when it doesn't feel like friendship. So I'm like, okay, not really friends. So because next to that is everybody changes, you know, so somebody who's a not really friend in fifth grade, that might actually turn into a close friend by your sophomore year because you've changed, they've changed.
Yes.
So stay open to the growth and changes in people, but be cautious and kind with those not really friends. You know, you might need to put some boundaries there. You might need to back away from that relationship, but give that young person or adult space to change because we are all, you know, we're all learning as we go.
All learning as we go. And that's interesting because I didn't talk about friendships, but obviously, I assume this would apply in the same vein as if it was an early relationship, you know, one of those boy-girl, girl, boy, whatever it may be, but your first foray into, for lack of a better term, the romantic, right? Mm-hmm. You know, when you're a young teen, everything is feels like it's romantic. And now I realize that's because, like you said, because they feel everything 1,000 times more than we do. Yes. Probably back then, if someone touched my hand, it was like, oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, world, I could rename that from the friendship pyramid to relationship pyramid, and it would be very similar, you know?
You're right.
So yeah. So if we're in a not really relationship, it's those same qualities. Hey, you know, be cautious. Put some boundaries there that's not really feeling like a relationship.
And that actually then leads me into the story. And because you love the social sciences, I was like, this, I think, would be a really good story for this episode. So I have a coworker, and it ties into all of this about how a parent can help in relationships with their kids and what some setting boundaries and what we're trying to teach our kids about themselves within these relationships as well. I have a coworker, and a few weeks ago, I heard something that really disturbed me. Now, I don't get into anybody's business. I was just, her desk was near mine, and she was telling everybody about it. And it disturbed me. She has a daughter who's 13. Now, keep in mind, again, culturally, she's a different culture than me as well. Let me caveat this by saying I technically have had very difficult relationships 99.9% of my life, very difficult ones. I'm very careful with what I try to have my daughter emulate. I'm like, don't worry, don't think about what I've been through. Think about now what mommy has learned, right? And I'm going to show you what I've learned so you don't make the same mistakes. So this lady was talking about her 13-year-old daughter, who is obviously in middle school, and she has her first boyfriend. Her daughter is very well defined physically at this age. And apparently the little boy is very jealous, very possessive, doesn't let her wear certain things, he's 13 to wear certain things, makes her feel bad about her body. Her daughter went to the mother and said, this kind of bothers me. Like, I have this body, but her mother says to her, well, if you didn't dress like a slut, we wouldn't have this problem. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, oh my God, there are certain things I would say to, you know, don't go outside a certain way, you know, just because, you know, sometimes you just don't want to draw unnecessary attention. But regardless of that, I would never say something like that to my child. And not to mention, then you're agreeing with this little boy and making your daughter self-conscious. She was like, oh, but she doesn't dress like that anymore. Now she wears all sweats. I said, so all you've done is make her believe that this little boy is not only making her feel self-conscious, telling her the truth about her body and herself, she's going to start believing this, which means every relationship she's in from now on, she's going to say, I can't be myself. I can't be comfortable in my own skin. I can't speak my mind about this. And whatever they say goes, right? I said, all she's doing exacerbating this. So some parents might hear this conversation and go, yeah, well, yeah, she's right. For parents that may have this situation and maybe want to steer clear of telling a 13-year-old, you can't be with that boyfriend, because you don't know, that's not going to happen. Although, to be honest, that's what I would say. I'd be like, you can see him in school, but don't bring that kid around here. You're done, right? Like, we're not going to do this. What is the correct, and again, I'll say correct with air quotes, because what would be the correct way to handle this? And I don't mean as the mother, I don't agree at all with what she said, absolutely at all. But in your expertise on this and trying to empower young women and have healthy relationships, what is your take on this? I know it's kind of long-winded, but I'm trying to really paint the picture as to how disturbing it actually was to hear.
Right. You know, it's so hard to hear. You know, I feel bad for that. You know, the daughter and the mom. But I would say, if we see our kids getting in really unhealthy relationships, although I was saying earlier, you know, don't get too involved, I do think we can start to help them recognize when they might not be in a healthy situation. So I would start again really calm. Tell me what you really like about this person, and how does he make you feel, and do you feel really respected in this relationship? So I would come at it first with some curiosity, non-judgment. So as soon as we dive in there that I'm judging the boyfriend, she's going to pull back, you know. Right. But if I can really calmly, conversationally, with curiosity, see what it is that she really likes about this guy. You know, and it could be at that age, if he's, you know, a boy with a lot of status, that could be it.
Of course.
So there's a lot of things that go into play in relationships in middle and high school. So just getting understanding what it is, but also helping to bring some awareness to her if she's not being treated well, and doing that as gently as possible. And so we have to be really careful, because like I said, as soon as we start sounding judgy, they're going to stop. And then the conversations about the appearance, I would have those separately. Like, I know as the mom of daughters, I don't actually comment on their appearance, except that I think you're amazing. You look wonderful. Girls, we talked earlier about how much confidence dips and how much pressure is in society to look a certain way. Like, I can see why they're dressing certain ways, because let's look at the media. Let's look at their influencers and their role models out there. So I feel for girls, you know, so I don't want to add any more pressure to them to look a certain way. So I am so careful about anything I say. I never comment on body weight. I never comment on, I'm just so... To me, that's like almost off limits for me to say to my girls, you know, unless I really need to talk about that, I do. That's a whole nother conversation. But back to the boy, I would definitely hone in. If you see your son or daughter in a really unhealthy relationship, you don't have to ignore that. Just enter gently with curiosity, trying to bring their awareness to that so they don't tune you out.
You know, I was very lucky. My mother wasn't, she was a lot of things, a lot of things, and she was a lot of not things, right? But one thing she always used to be like, don't say that about yourself, or don't talk about yourself like that, you know? And I never knew where that came from necessarily, because that was kind of the only time that I would hear her even speak on really anything, was don't say those kind of things. And I used to be like, okay, it's about me, it's not about somebody else, like, you know. But it's not till you get older and you hear it from one of your kids, you hear someone else say it, you go, wow, that's really bad. Like, why would I speak to someone else nicer than I speak to myself? And you know what, I feel like that's really, you really need to instill that in your kids. Like I always say, you can't love anybody properly unless you love yourself fully first, right? Like no one's gonna give that gift to you. That's something you give to yourself. And it saddened me, and I was like, I can't be the only one that thinks that was wrong, you know. I can't judge another parent. I don't know more context, obviously, just what it was that she had said. But even the way she said it was like, oh my God. I was like, that's a 13-year-old. That's a baby. That is a child. And all you're doing is giving that, you know, that toughness, you know, that toughness to them that they're going to have as they get older. She's going to hear that every single time she dresses some way, or anytime she does anything. She might start to make certain choices based on getting people's approval. Right. And I know for a fact, when you start to look for attention, you're not usually going to get the positive attention. It's going to be the negative attention, you know, and at that age, attention is attention. It doesn't matter. You know, now you did mention, because it's part of this, what we're talking about, is how middle school, of course, can be tough on confidence. And how can we help them with their resilience? Like to say, I mean, we know that we're going to say things like, okay, it gets better. It's not the end of the world. Trust me, life goes on. You know, you're going to look back in this and 3 years, 4 years, 10 years ago, that was so silly. But the reality is, I know for a fact, for me, there are things I look back 25, 30 years that still were traumatizing to me, that I've had to heal from that little Teresa, because they were so traumatizing from that specific time in my life, in my social groups. So how do we get them to understand and not keep those things bottled up until they're in their 40s and they're sitting in therapy having to talk and write a letter to little so-and-so?
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that helps them, we talked about this earlier, is when they are really down, helping them feel heard. You know, so that is one step in helping them start to find their own resiliency. It's, they've got that, whatever happened, they got out, and they're somehow maybe now navigating those emotions in hopefully a healthy way. So that is going to help with resilience. Another thing is, you know, sharing some of those times when we were really down and out, and you know, how we came out of that. You know, sometimes they roll their eyes because we grew up, you know, way long ago in the dark ages.
Black and white, apparently, I was told. I was like, wait.
But they might, you know, when they're in those darker places, it's when those stories might matter. Like, hold those stories for those moments when they are really going to hear them, you know, so when they are in a really similar situation. And then just keep, I can't even tell you how important it is for us to keep telling our kids how much we love them and how proud we are of them.
Oh,
you know,
so that's
a huge foundation. They know that we love them as they are, and we are so proud of them. So they've got this foundation at home. We believe them. We know they can do this. So those things combined will just help them, and know that, you know, there are going to be ups and downs. You know, middle school is tricky. High school is tricky. And sometimes our biggest growth is from those darkest moments.
Yes.
You know, that's where we emerge, you know, as a changed person sometimes, and learn some really valuable lessons. So as hard as that is to see, those things happen. So I'm not against in those deep, dark moments, you know, if they're really down, get some popcorn, pop in a movie, you know, that might actually illustrate something, you know, some resilience. So think about what movies are super inspiring. So, yes. You know, use those moments to lean in, you know, and say, hey, let's do a movie night. You know, hey, let's watch this. You know, so you can be with them, but you don't have to be like talking all the time. You can sit side by side, watch something together. They know they're not alone. They know you got their back. But I'm all about great books and media, you know, when things are great, things are tough.
Agreed. I love having those resources and just being sometimes able, some sitting and watching a movie sometimes, it's so cathartic, right? It's so you're sitting there and you're just, even if you're not talking, it's that shared space. It's that shared comfort. I always say sometimes just sitting there watching a movie that you will love. Mm-hmm. You can recite every line to, whatever the case may be. It just kind of brings you back to a moment where you can all just be one and say, okay, look, we're in this together, you know, because I think a lot of times too, there's a moment in my life. I was 14. I'll never forget it. Me and my mother did not have a relationship from the time I was like 11. Like we obviously, she raised me, but I mean a personal, emotional, really relationship. It was always adversarial until I was pregnant with my daughter. And so I always used to say, I know she may love me, but I wonder why she doesn't like me. Right. I used to say that all the time as a teenager. I used to be like, this doesn't make any sense. Right. And when I was about 14, I remember my aunts and my mom were in the living room and I'm walking upstairs. And she asked me to do something. I don't know. And I was, to be honest, I could have been 16. Either way, I was a teenager, but I remember going, however I answered her, and I start to walk up the stairs, and I can hear her telling my aunts, you know, the way she talks to me sometimes hurts me so much. And I remember thinking to myself, well, I didn't say anything. Like, what did I say? And I used to think, she's like, it's the way you said it. I was like, what do you mean it's the way I said it? Like, and I got to the point that as an adult of a teen daughter, I catch myself saying the same things. Exactly that. It's not what you're saying. It's the fact that you're rolling your eyes when you're saying it. It's the fact that you're talking to me like mom's a piece of crap and she doesn't know anything about the world I'm living in. And I don't want to hear this nonsense today. You know, it's that tone, like whatever, you know, peasant. I always say whatever peasant, get out of my face kind of thing. Right. So how can parents, especially when you're going through a really hard time, there are some kids that are just difficult. How can a parent really try to break through? We can try to communicate to our blue in the face. And sometimes it just doesn't. It goes in one ear and out the other. Do we just let them come to us? Or, you know, what is a way that parents can feel that, okay, I've done everything. I don't know what else to do.
Yeah. You know, you touched on something that's really important. 70% of our communication is our body language and our tone of voice. Mm-hmm. You know, we think it's the words, but actually it's our tone, yes, our facial expressions and our body language. So remember the importance of that. You know, the expression on our face, the tone of our voice is huge. And yes, you know, the other thing is, don't take things personally. You know, so kids are going to roll their eyes. Kids are going to have a snarky tone because they're teens and they're individuating. And so if we don't take that personally, you know, that's going to go a long way. It doesn't mean we don't have to allow bad behavior. You know, sometime we could say, hey, can you try to rephrase that another way? But notice I didn't say, hey, rephrase that another way. I said, hey, let's try that again. Right. So I am so conscious of my tone and my facial expressions because I think that opens the door to connection and communication. So those little things, not taking anything personally and really watching our body language, can just start to change that. And the other thing with something that was so profound to me when I was getting into this work is I was listening to a presenter and she said, every kid and teen needs somebody that lights up when they enter the room. They need a person that lights up. And I'm like, oh, I want to be that person. You know, I want to be that person for my kids. So I do, as corny as that sounds, you know, my kids come home and I light up and I am psyched to see them. And I, you know, I try not to be annoying. You know, it's really easy to be annoying.
But your mom is always going to be annoying.
I just want them to know I am so glad they're here. You know, I just love being around them. And that opens the door for them to relax too. You know, they know they're loved and they're welcome at home. And even when they're grumpy and annoying, they know that no matter what, if they come in a super grumpy mood, I'm still glad to see them. I'm glad they're home. So those little things can make a huge difference. Not immediately. Now, if we've had some tense interactions a lot, it's going to take some time. So don't expect changes overnight. See over a couple weeks and a couple months of us not taping things personally, us being really aware of our body language and tone of voice, what we're saying, and being super excited to have them around. See what that does. Just test it out. Test it out.
I love that because I always say I'm like, I sometimes like the dog because I wait for them at the door.
Yeah.
I'm always like, hi. And I wait at the door if I'm, you know, working from home. I'm like, and I walk in and the first thing I do is pop in each room. And I'm like, you know, some, I remember like when I was a kid, I don't remember seeing my mother until like dinner time. I was like, oh, I was in my room. And, but for my kids, I'm like, I pop in the rooms like, how was your day? And, you know, I'm glad we're home. We're all home safe together. Thank God. And, you know, and then how, you know, all those kind of things. And tell me about your day. Like I tell my son, what was your day like? Ask specific questions because all we'll get most of us is fine. Good. I'm like, what'd you have for lunch? Who did you sit with at lunch? You know, things like that. Like, get some information, you know. And I'm the same way still with my daughter, you know, because I know that she's been especially struggling. And I'm like, what did you do today? What was a win that you feel you had today? This is something that we're learning as well, me and her, is what was a win you had today? Let's share our wins today, even if it's something small, you know. And if it's something as a family, it's something individual, whatever it is. Because then when you go put your head at night, you're hopefully focusing on that win.
Yeah.
As opposed to anything else that might, you know, hopefully it's contagious. It's supposed to be contagious. Yeah.
All those little things you're doing are showing that they matter, and they're showing that they are loved, and they're showing that they have a home base. So every time you do that, it's a little gift. It's a little gift to them.
And I think to us as well as parents when you do those things, right? Because again, you know, a lot of us parent from places that we only know. Right. And being able to step out of that comfort zone and teach a parent in ways we don't know, which it can be so uncomfortable for some of us. Right. Some of us are so culturally ingrained in things like corporal punishment, for example, like I was raised, to then saying, I'm not going to do that to my kids because I know that that was emotionally and physically and mentally damaging. Right. But I have moments where I'm not perfect. I scream at my kids. I've cursed in their direction. I've slammed doors and said, don't talk to me because we're human. But I think back in the day, that was, well, that's what it was. Now it's kind of like I sit there and I'm able to reflect and say, okay, now you need to have the conversation, right? You weren't regulated. You didn't know how to handle certain situations. You were stressed. Now go talk to them. And I think that's the difference with parenting now versus parenting then. I do still believe people should discipline their kids. There are some badass kids out there. But I think the majority, like I said earlier, are just really trying to be more empathy, you know, more socially active, more activism. That's what we're looking for. Because the world around us, it's never been safe, but I feel like it's so much more unsafe than it's been in a really, really long time. And trying to keep them as safe in their own home as possible is what we need to work on.
And know that we're all going to goof up. So parents are listening to this and be like, oops, I didn't do that. It's never too late. I've actually gone in with some repair conversations 10 years after the fact because I learned something that I did really poorly when my kids were toddlers. You know, I didn't know. And so I will 10 years later be like, you know what? I learned this and I didn't do this when you were a toddler. And I wish I had. I just want you to know that. Had I known that then, this is what I would have done differently. And I'm sorry about that.
You don't know what you don't know.
Yeah. And so give grace to yourselves, parents. You know, we're all messing up. We're all doing the best we can. We're messing up in some ways and it's okay. It's never too late to repair.
I agree with that completely. Absolutely. You know, we're coming to the end of our conversation and I have loved speaking with you because you've actually made me feel better in ways because I was always scared of repeating patterns. And after when you were just talking about old conversations, I've had to do that with my daughter as well because she's seen me go through a lot, you know, especially with your first kids. They're kind of like the first pancake, you know, it's never perfect. You know, they're growing with you and they're learning with you and you're kind of raising yourself at the same time as you're raising them. You're just at the seat of your pants. And I've had to do the same thing. I've had to go back and say, listen, I know you've seen mommy go through some stuff. And I know how I've seen how it's affected you as well in certain ways, you know, with this relationships with their fathers, whatever the case may be. And no, I wasn't perfect and I'm still not perfect, you know, and I'm aware that I still make these mistakes and, you know, and I think that's really important to really try as much as you can to go back. Because sometimes actually hindsight, when they say hindsight is 20/20, that's sometimes the better time to have those conversations. When you're less emotional about them.
Yeah.
You know, at that moment. So I want to ask you, What's next for you? Any upcoming projects or books we should look out for?
I am just actually writing the final chapter of one of my next books. All my books so far are kids kind of in the preteen, early teen years.
Right.
I'm just finishing one, hopefully in the next 2 weeks, that is all about actually mindfulness. Believe it or not, I'm going to try to tackle how to help kids learn how to be mindful, especially it's in direct response to just anxiety and depression in youth today. One of the ways that they can learn to, again, self-regulate and
self-regulate,
learn to calm down, learn to focus is mindfulness.
Yes.
This book is all about that. I'm almost done. It takes a while. And then it goes into editing and there's going to be illustrations in that book. So 2026, look for that.
But listen, that'll be here before we blink our eyes.
I know. So I'm working on that. And that's been great. It's funny. It's really helped my own mindfulness and self-regulation writing that book. So it's been a treat to write.
That's awesome. And please tell the audience where they can find you, where they can buy your books, all your information.
Thank you. And what a pleasure to talk to you, Teresa. It's been a joy. Thank you for hosting me. And the easiest place to find me is my website, which is Jessica Spear, S-P as in Peter, E-E-R. That has links off to my social media and also where to buy my books, which they are available anywhere books are sold. Yeah, so of course you can get them on Amazon, but they're in Barnes & Noble, Target. Your local bookstore might have them as well. Also write, you know, regular free e-newsletter on all these topics. So you'll see information about that. You can download free resources like the Friendship Pyramid and other resources like that. So my hope, you know, the underlying reason I'm doing all this work is to help kids and parents connect. You know, so that's kind of the underlying theme of everything I do.
I love that. And I'm going to put it all in the show notes. I know you sent me a package as well. So I'm going to put all that in the show notes to get all information out so anybody can reach you if they like. Jessica, it's been amazing. And that's a wrap on this episode of Prosecco Queens Podcast. It's been an incredible conversation. So if there's one thing we're taking away today, it's that raising kids in today's world isn't just about them. It's about us too. The way we guide them through friendships, technology, and social struggles is also an opportunity to reflect, grow, and even heal parts of ourselves. Parenting isn't easy. No one ever said it was. Raising young women and young men comes with challenges that can test our patience, our values, and sometimes even our sanity. But as we continue the series, we're going to explore how being intentional, learning alongside our kids, and choosing to do things differently can set the next generation up for success and give us a little more peace of mind in the process, hopefully. Jessica, another huge thank you to you for sharing your wisdom and to our listeners for joining in this conversation. If you love today's episode, be sure to check out Jessica's books. Trust me, they are game changers for navigating those tricky years. And if something we talked about today resonated with you, share this episode with a friend, a fellow parent, or anyone who could use a little extra support in their parenting journey. Make sure you've subscribed and listen in for our next series. We've got some powerful conversations ahead. And as always, keep those glasses full and those hearts open. Until next time, cheers to raising strong, self-aware kids, and maybe even healing a little bit of ourselves along the way. Peace out. Drop a sunshine.